surgery if that's what they're wanting to do. So the reason that we started doing this retrospective data was that healthcare providers were hesitant to prescribe cross-sex hormones to young people in the teenage years. There are competing ideas about when the transitioning with hormones should occur, and we don't follow a specific protocol, but we treat everyone sort of individually. Am I just clicking this for the next one?
The arrow. Or whatever.
The arrow. Okay, got it. Okay, I don't have any financial relationships with commercial interests. If anyone knows any commercial interests that would like to invest in me, I'd be happy to. Just kidding. So today what I'd like to do is just describe our current population of youth basically, and hopefully you can understand some of the physiologic changes expected from cross-hormone therapy. And I think you've heard a little bit already from Dr. Forbes about our interdisciplinary approach to youth at the Division of Adolescent Medicine. I think you all know this, but I put in some basic definitions about transgender. I'm just going to assume you all know this and go to my data here. Well, why do we believe that starting hormones earlier can help our young people? Well, it can increase our opportunities for preventive health care. It can improve functioning, school performance, family, social functioning, prevent suffering and risk-taking. A lot of young people that we see are suicidal when they come to us. And it can lead to maybe some social change and improve their quality of life. So what are the three views on adolescent treatment? This is kind of around the world. There are some people that believe you shouldn't do any treatment until 18 years old. Some people believe you should allow the young people to experience some of their puberty and then start to keep them from progressing and then start gender hormones between age 15 and 16. And some people believe if the criteria for gender identity disorder is fulfilled, then that you should start the Lupron at a young age or the puberty suppressors, and then initiate hormones several years later. And we've kind of done combinations of these things depending on our different youth. What's the goal of our treatment? Improve quality of life for young people and by facilitating their transition and make their physical state more closely represent their sense of themselves. Well, who do we see at Children's Hospital Los Angeles? We draw patients from all over the region. Sometimes we actually have young people come from out of the state to get services. We have patients from up in Santa Barbara that come down to see us, down here in San Diego that come up to see us. You heard a little bit about our TG AIM program from Dr. Forbes. We also have, did you talk about Tranny Rockstar a little bit? I brought a few handouts and also a few copies of our calendar. I don't know if Dr. Forbes got to talk about this, but it was very exciting. Our Tranny Rockstar Youth did the first transgender calendar ever made. And it's really beautiful and well done. These are all our patients. All 12 of these people are patients of ours, so it was really exciting. So then my data that I'm going to be presenting today is very preliminary. I actually have not done an analysis on all of our youth, but we're really trying to show, to demonstrate the efficacy of cross-hormone therapy. What do? When we start treatment with people, we educate them that it's a slow process. It varies from individual to individual. We really spend a lot of time talking about the risks and benefits of hormone treatment, what things are going to be reversible, what things are going to be irreversible. We really require them to go through a certain process that I'll go over in a little bit, and then talk to them about what the consequences of not following the health plan. I think we're like a lot of treatment centers, but unlike some treatment centers in that we do require ongoing counseling for at least some period of time. Our young people are required to have a mental health assessment. They usually start by seeing our case manager, who they give all their information to, and then they get a psychological assessment and ongoing care as determined by our psychologist. Then they see myself or Dr. Marvin Belzer for a medical assessment. We all meet together in a chart review and a team meeting to discuss the readiness for hormones of the particular patient, and then we proceed from there. So what do our youth look like? We tried to get as close in this data analysis to a year of treatment as possible, but we have a lot of young people who kind of come in and out of treatment, so our numbers are fairly low. We had 16 patients that we were able to get data on so far, female to male. The ethnic breakdown was here. The black numbers are the actual numbers of kids, and the blue numbers are the percentages. You don't see that most of them Latino, and then a little smattering amongst the others. We assessed about if they were ever sexually active. 62.5% no, 31% yes, and then one patient had been a victim of sexual abuse. Highest grade level achieved. You can kind of see what it is there. What's our therapeutic goals for our female to male patients? Male pattern hair growth, obviously increased muscle mass, amenorrhea, breast reduction, and deepening of the voice. What are the concerns that providers have? Well, what people worry about from a physiologic perspective is, you know, an increase in the lipid profile, making young people more to taking on the profile of a biological male for cardiac heart disease. So that's one big concern. There's also concerns about the liver enzymes being elevated. Obviously, male pattern baldness, not so much with grave physiologic consequences, but certainly psychological consequences for people. Mood changes, weight gain, acne is a big thing that people worry about, and an increase in hemoglobin. So what did we pull out of our data? We looked at the physiologic markers we looked at were blood pressure, weight, hemoglobin, liver function, glucose, and cholesterol. We also actually asked about side effects, but we haven't done the data on that yet. So here's what we found. This was, you see that blood pressure, the systolic blood pressure on the left and the diastolic on the right, a mild increase in systolic blood pressure, a mild decrease in diastolic blood pressure, none of this of any physiologic consequence whatsoever. Weight gain, statistically significant. Average weight went from about 140 to 150. Hemoglobin from 13.6 to 14.9 after treatment. Also not clinically significant. It's statistically significant, but not clinically significant. So that's an important piece for providers to recognize. Liver function tests, again, you see a bump in both of the transaminases, but neither one of these is clinically significant. Glucose, we actually saw a slight reduction in. Again, both of those numbers are below diabetic numbers, so we're not worried. Total cholesterol, it looks like a big gap there, but it just is 168 to 169, not clinically or statistically significant. Triglycerides, again, these were not fasting levels, so this data right here showed us that perhaps we need to do fasting triglyceride levels and think about it a little bit more in our patients. So what was clinically significant? What was statistically significant? Okay, so weight was clinically significant in that generally our female to males want to gain weight. So that was a really good improvement for us. Triglycerides increased, but again, non-fasting levels, so we don't really know if that's significant or not. Cholesterol and hemoglobin, statistically significant, but not clinically significant. Let's look at our male to female patients. We had 28 patients that we looked at. Here's their ethnic breakdown. 57% Latino, and then another smattering. Educational level, so it's a little bit, most of our young people had finished high school. Not as many statistically had gone on beyond that as our female to male patients. Sexually active, also 74% yes in this group and 25.9% no. So a little bit different than our other group. Sex work, about a quarter said yes. And then street hormone use prior to coming to us for hormone therapy, we did have, you know, about a third that had used hormones before. Previous estrogen use, yes, you know, few of them. So why do we do feminizing hormones? Well, we want to induce the development of female secondary sexual characteristics, and we want to decrease the effects of androgens in the body. Which hormones and medications? Most commonly estrogen used, but also seen are spironolactone or aldactone, which you can use to help decrease the hair growth and soften the hair. And then we used to use progesterone a lot, but we don't use it as much now just because we saw a lot of weight gain in our patients with it. So you see it tapering off, and you'll see this in a minute. So type of estrogen therapy, most of our young people are on injectable del-estrogen. It's very inexpensive, it's very effective, and we get to see them because they come in for their injections every 2 weeks. Progesterone treatment, the majority of about half were on something, half weren't. But of the ones who are, most of them were on Provera. We had two kids on Depo Provera in the past. And then, again, about 40%, about half on spironolactone of varying doses. What are the risks? Well, the reasons providers get nervous about prescribing hormones in young people, or in any people, but particularly in young people, is because there haven't been great studies on transgender people. So most of the studies, the research is limited to like hormone replacement therapy after menopause. So the safety data is kind of lacking, and most of the use of the hormones is off-label. What are the medical risks? Well, in theory, we know for biologic females that go on either birth control or hormone replacement therapy that estrogen is increases the amount of blood clotting, in theory. Gallstone disease, liver disease, weight gain, mood swings, and elevation in prolactin, and development of prolactinomas, or prolactin-secreting tumors, and high blood pressure. So what did we look at? Well, here's this elevation in prolactin was statistically significant after a year of treatment with estrogen. Again, not clinically significant, so that's an important distinction there. Blood pressure actually went down a little bit in our patients, statistically significant, so systolic and diastolic both went down. Liver function tests also not very much change, actually a little decrease in the ALT there. Weight change. So we see also in our male to female population a little bit of weight gain, and that's probably, my guess, comes from the young people that were on Provera. Cholesterol decrease. So there's an interesting trade-off too, that you're giving up your biologic profile for heart disease with a little bit of lowering of your cholesterol. Again, this is preliminary data, but I anticipate it's going to be the same when we get the whole group analyzed. So aldactone, one of the things about spironolactone is that we get concerned that you lose potassium in the body, so we looked at this too. Not clinically significant, a little bit of a drop, but not at all worrisome from a clinical perspective. Testosterone, well, this is what we're looking for, so this is a good change from 457 to about 24. Conclusions. Okay, so what we found in our very early data is that it's actually relatively safe to prescribe cross-sex hormones in the teenage population. Our study subjects range from 12 to 24. Our youngest patient that we have is a 12-year-old female-to-male patient who's on a really low dose of testosterone, but it's enough to really suppress his menstrual cycle, which was really the thing that brought him in to see us, as he was just starting to go through puberty and really had his first period and was suicidal about it. So I went through this long, protracted thing of arguing with the insurance company to get him Lupron, because ideally I would have wanted to stop his puberty, given him about a year or so to do a little counseling with us, and then progress him through on testosterone. But because I just couldn't get the cooperation and the insurance company to pay for it, I just started him on testosterone, a very low dose. So what we really need are larger and longer studies to assess the safety of cross-hormone therapy. And we also need, we started doing this data because I think where the real battle is going to be won in the medical community and in the insurance community is going to be showing that quality of life, with data, that quality of life is improved. We know anecdotally, because we work with these patients all the time, that quality of life goes up. But what we really need is data for our adolescent population to show that we are decreasing suicide risk, that we're decreasing rates of depression, and that quality of life is going up for these young people. So I think we're well on our way. And thanks so much for hanging in there, and I really appreciate it.
Yes.
Hi, Dr. Olson.
Yep.
What's your youngest patient on hormone therapy?
Our youngest patient is 12. It's a female-to-male patient on testosterone. For some reason, we have a little bit of a skewed population where we get younger female-to-male patients than our male-to-female patients. We haven't really done we have some theories about why that might be. They generally, overall, our female-to-male patients have better family support. They actually have families, I could say, is, you know, that they come in generally with a mom or a mom and a dad or a dad who's supportive of that transition. Our male to female patients generally tend to be, have a little bit more sort of life chaos, I guess, for lack of a better term, going on. And I don't know if we're just seeing them because they're kind of past that age of living with their families. We have some theories about that. But yeah, our youngest patient is 12.
And in terms of consent for the younger patients, and also just also what percentage are homeless, if you know that?
Ooh, do you know our homeless percentage?
We have a good number who are in the foster care system.
Yeah, so consent-wise, anybody under 18 has to have a parental or a guardian, whatever that, whatever form that takes, if it's DCFS or a foster care provider, has to sit with us and go over the consent so that they understand everything that's going on. And also, we really do try to do our best to get both parents, if possible, to sit down. If there are two parents to sit down and discuss hormones with, we try to get both parents in to actually sign the form so they understand that there are issues around fertility and there are issues around irreversible things that are going to go on with hormones.
Do you have to advocate on behalf of your patients to their parents or guardians if they're unwilling?
All the time. It's really funny being trained in pediatrics. My most unreasonable group of people are parents. There's no question. I've had parents screaming on the phone to me. I mean, here's the irony, right? We're at a public health thing here, so you all know. I had a parent screaming on the phone with me, "You're making money off our kids, giving them hormones and changing boys into girls and girls into boys." And I thought, I wish I'm making money. I'm not making money off this. What are you talking about? And so we all the time were giving resources. I write letters to the court because a lot of times our kids in the foster system, they can't get, there's difficulty in our foster system getting kids okayed for hormones. And it's an interesting cycle because we have a lot of young people, because they're not transitioning, they're living in that tension and that anger and that rage and madness that comes from not being in the right body. And it's causing them to do things that now the foster care placements say, oh, I don't want to give them...